Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Lessons of the insurrection. Law enforcement officials testify on the many security failures that allowed a violent mob of Trump supporters to storm the Capitol. Then, getting the vaccine. Manufacturers face questions about supply and efficacy of treatments as the inoculation campaign accelerates. And a generational gap. The pandemic exacerbates the many health and economic stresses of grandparents raising children in the U.S.
It's just not something you economically plan for. I'm a single grandmother rolling the rock back up the hill.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The men who were in charge of security during the U.S. Capitol assault have told their story in public for the first time. Their testimony today at a U.S. Senate hearing was a tale of bad communications, bad intelligence, and blame-laying. Congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins reports.
It began powerfully. Capitol Police Captain Carnation Mendoza told senators of hours of hand-to-hand combat to secure the Capitol Rotunda on January 6th.
I received chemical burns to my face that still have not healed to this day. Officers begged me for relief as they were unsure how long they could physically hold the door closed, with the crowd continually banging on the outside of the door, attempting to gain reentry.
This in a Capitol complex now surrounded by razor wire, where on January 6th, a complete breakdown of security left 5 killed, another 2 deaths by suicide, and some 140 people injured. Senators heard from the top security officials during the attack. Former House Sergeant at Arms Paul Irving pointed to an intelligence failure.
Based on the intelligence, we all believed that the plan met the threat and that we were prepared. We now know that we had the wrong plan.
As did former Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund.
We properly planned for a mass demonstration with possible violence. What we got was a military-style coordinated assault on my officers and a violent takeover of the Capitol building.
But Sund also indicated other internal problems.
I acknowledge that under the pressure of an unprecedented attack, a number of systems broke down.
And above it all, the question of why the National Guard was not deployed sooner. D.C. Metropolitan Police Chief Robert Conti. His forces were ready but waiting to be invited to respond to the riot.
I was surprised at the reluctance to immediately send the National Guard to the Capitol grounds. In the meantime, by 2:30 p.m., the district had requested additional officers from as far away as New Jersey.
Everett Sesker is a security consultant who directed the State Police Training Commission in Maryland. In video of the chaos, he sees training and leadership issues.
I saw a lot of good officers trying to do their best. But on the other hand, I saw a lot of confusion. I saw a lot of officers with no real direction.
Some also raise a failure of structure, that the lack of barriers, the breakable glass, and the building itself were as great a problem.
When was the last time something like this happened at the Capitol? Not in my lifetime, not in your lifetime. 1812, I think. So War of 1812. So now we're dealing with complacency. We have to battle that.
Back at the hearing.
Do we have a failure to communicate here?
News of major internal issues. Then Police Chief Sund says he raised the idea of calling in the National Guard 2 days before the attack.
I met with Mr. Irving in his office. That's where I made the first request for the National Guard. He had indicated, I don't know if I really like the optics.
Capitol Police cannot request the National Guard. They answer to a board dominated by the sergeants at arms. And they didn't think the guard was necessary. Irving says that was based on intelligence, not optics. Then on the day of the attack, those wires crossed again. Sund says delaying another National Guard request at a critical hour.
Mr. Sund, do you know when you asked for National Guard assistance? Was it 1:09 or was it 2 p.m.?
It was 1:09, sir.
1:09. And who did you ask for assistance at 1:09?
It was from Mr. Irving, I believe.
No, I did not get a request at 1:09 that I can remember.
So, Georgia Senator John Ossoff summed up the issue.
The Capitol Police Board. So there is no individual who has personal responsibility for the security of the U.S. Capitol complex.
That's the way I interpret it, yes.
Another failure. An FBI intelligence report the night before the attack clearly warned that Trump supporters were, quote, ready for war. But word never got through to either Sergeant at Arms or to the Capitol Police Chief.
I actually just in the last 24 hours was informed by the department that they actually had received that report.
The hearing is just part of the January 6th response. Capitol Police are investigating some of its officers. Speaker Nancy Pelosi is calling for a 9/11 style commission, and she has launched a security review by retired Army General Russell Honoré. Meantime, at least 5,000 National Guard troops will remain at least a few more weeks. The temporary fencing and military-like zone for blocks around the Capitol will stay up, though many members of Congress want it to go. Eleanor Holmes Norton represents Washington, D.C. in Congress. She says all of this hampers Congress, harms nearby neighborhoods, and is no longer needed.
All of this should be done gradually. Those National Guards are needed at home. They certainly aren't needed now. If we have not had a deterrent effect by now, we'll never have one. And I think that deterrent effect has set in.
But others want it to stay. In a statement, Acting Capitol Police Chief Yogananda Pittman called for the fencing to become permanent.
This was planned. We now know this was a planned insurrection.
The hearing is a first step in a potentially long look at the tangled security failures at the Capitol. Next week, lawmakers will talk with officials from the FBI and the Pentagon. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
And for more on today's hearing, our Yamiche Alcindor joins me now from the White House, which is where you were on the day of the Capitol attack. Yamiche, there were other flashpoints at the hearing. You were following it closely. Tell us what else you heard today.
That's right. This was a striking hearing on Capitol Hill where lawmakers as well as law enforcement officials were going into detail and at times reliving that siege on the Capitol, talking about the lies as well as the failures that led to that attack. There was this big consensus, it seemed, among lawmakers that things need to get better, that this needs to be prevented. But there were also fireworks, and those fireworks centered on three Republican senators in particular, Josh Hawley of Missouri, Ted Cruz of Texas, as well as Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. For Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley in particular, those lawmakers, those senators, are facing a lot of backlash because even after the attack, they voted against certifying the results of the election. And there were some who really saw it as ironic and at times even wrong that they were able to then question law enforcement officials about what they could have done differently, when there are a lot of people who think those two senators should have done things differently. Democrats, of course, see that they're part of this big lie that they talk about. What that is, of course, being that they saying that the election was stolen from President Trump, which it was not. Josh Hawley in particular also used his time questioning law enforcement officials to criticize Lieutenant General Russell Honoré. Now, he is a retired general who House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has tapped to do a review of the attack. Josh Hawley in the hearing was saying that essentially he should not have said that there were police officers who were, quote unquote, complicit in the attack. And he was asking law enforcement officials whether or not they were complicit. So that was really seen as him criticizing Lieutenant General Honoré. Also, Senator Ron Johnson, he was spreading at times disinformation in this hearing. He was suggesting that there were left-wing provocateurs as well as fake Trump supporters who were responsible for this attack. But Judy, that's just not right. The large number of people who carried out this attack, they were Trump supporters. They were wearing Trump symbols. They were also chanting and going after some of the targets that President Trump, former President Trump, had laid out, including, of course, former Vice President Mike Pence. All of this is that the White House is really watching this closely and hoping that their Attorney General nominee, Merrick Garland, will be able to handle some of this once he gets into office.
Well, we know the investigation into all of this is going to continue. Yamiche Alcindor at the White House, thank you. In the day's other news, more world leaders appeal for fair distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said wealthier countries are getting the lion's share. He called for the United Nations to intervene.
De 80 países.
Out of 80 countries that have the vaccine, 10 are hoarding 80% of it. And the 70 remaining, which is where we and many others are, have 20% of the vaccines. But there are more than 100 countries that don't have a single dose.
Meanwhile, vaccine makers Pfizer and Moderna said they expect to ship 220 million doses for U.S. use by the end of March. We'll return to vaccine issues after the news summary. The pandemic forced President Biden and Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to meet by video link this afternoon. It was the new American president's first meeting with a foreign leader. The agenda included COVID-19, climate change, and economic recovery. UN nuclear inspectors now say that Iran is enriching uranium to 20% purity. That's a big step closer to weapons grade. It is Iran's latest violation of the 2015 nuclear accord, which the U.S. left in 2018. Tehran has also begun restricting UN inspections at its nuclear sites. The U.S. Senate today easily confirmed Linda Thomas-Greenfield to be ambassador to the United Nations. And Tom Vilsack won confirmation for a second stint as Secretary of Agriculture. The Interior Secretary nominee, New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland, had her confirmation hearing. She addressed Republican criticism of her opposition to oil and gas drilling.
There's no question that fossil energy does and will continue to play a major role in America for years to come. But we must also recognize that the energy industry is innovating, and our climate challenge must be addressed.
At a separate hearing, California's Attorney General Javier Becerra made his case to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. He vowed to rebuild trust in public health institutions.
Science must come first. We must ensure that people trust what we say. We have a ways to go to regain the trust of the American people. But if we let the experts, as we said, the scientists lead, I believe soon people will see the results.
A number of Senate Republicans have argued that Becerra is unqualified and overly partisan. A grand jury in Rochester, New York, has voted not to file criminal charges against police in the death of Daniel Prude. Prude, who is black, was held down, naked, and handcuffed last March until he stopped breathing. It touched off nightly protests. The state attorney general said today that she was extremely disappointed in the grand jury decision. Golfing great Tiger Woods is hospitalized in Los Angeles tonight after he crashed his car and needed surgery for multiple leg injuries. Authorities say crews had to pull Woods out through the windshield of the mangled wreck. He was taken away in serious condition. Late today, authorities said there was no evidence of impairment on his part at the crash scene. In economic news, the chair of the Federal Reserve gave a guarded outlook at a Senate hearing today. Jerome Powell said that recovery from the pandemic still has far to go. He also played down concerns that new stimulus spending could ignite inflation.
Inflation dynamics do change over time, but they don't change on a dime. And so we don't really see how a burst of fiscal support or spending that doesn't last for many years would actually change those inflation dynamics.
Powell said that the Fed will continue policies aimed at boosting economic growth and hiring. Four leaders of the power grid operator for Texas are resigning in the fallout from last week's winter storm. All of them live outside the state. More than 4 million customers in Texas lost power for days during frigid weather. Others face astronomical charges for electricity. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to close at 31,537. The Nasdaq fell 67 points, and the S&P 500 added 4. And poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti, patron of the Beat Movement, has died at his home in San Francisco. He had lung cancer. His City Lights bookstore was a beat haven in the 1950s, and he published books by Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and others. His own work sold more than 1 million copies. Lawrence Ferlinghetti was 101 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, manufacturers face questions about supply as the vaccination campaign accelerates. Europe struggles with shortages and appointment cancellations in its effort to inoculate. The pandemic exacerbates the many stresses of grandparents raising children, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour. from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West, from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
It is one of the most pressing questions in the pandemic right now. When can I and my loved ones get a shot? So far, 65 million Americans have received at least one shot of either the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine. Between those two and a third expected vaccine from Johnson & Johnson, companies have pledged as many as 700 million doses by this summer. But there are concerns over just meeting supply and demand this spring. That was the subject of a congressional hearing today. John Yang has the details.
Judy, the leaders of five vaccine manufacturers told Congress today they'd be stepping up production and distribution in the coming days. The CDC says Moderna and Pfizer have delivered a total of more than 82 million doses so far. The companies say they'll deliver nearly twice that many more by the end of March. Right now, about 1.6 million Americans are being vaccinated each day. But at that rate, it will take about a year to vaccinate all adults in the country. Science correspondent Miles O'Brien has been tracking all of this for us. Miles, what's the holdup? Why is this not moving as fast as so many people would hope it would?
Well, John, as I think a lot of people know by now, the two vaccines that have the emergency use authorization are an entirely different way of doing vaccines. Messenger RNA, it's a piece of genetic material that teaches our own body to produce what looks like the spiky coronavirus protein, and thus in turn teaches our body that it's a bad thing and to go after it. It's a great way to train the immune system. But that messenger RNA, if you just inject the RNA into your system, it melts like a snowflake. It has to be in a package, and the package in this case are so-called nanolipids, tiny little balls of fat, essentially, that enable the mRNA to survive till it gets to the cell that it needs to do the work it needs to get to. Well, the production of these lipids is very specific, customized, bespoke. It requires something on the order of 10 steps and machines which did not exist prior to this being approved. And so it's taken a lot longer to get all the lipids in place to make these vaccines deliverable. The companies say they're past the worst part of this, and hopefully they can begin ramping up.
And will, there are more vaccines in the pipeline that don't rely on this technology. Will getting emergency approval for those, will that speed things up?
Yeah, that'll help quite a bit. You know, the companies, first of all, they've banded together. They have manufacturing agreements, so they're starting to ramp up production by using their competitors' facilities, which is a good thing. And then there's a third vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which should be approved pretty soon, really any day now. It is a single-dose vaccine and can be refrigerated instead of delivered at dry ice temperatures. And has a lot of promise. And that one is about to come in the mix. So that is going to help the picture significantly. You know, it's interesting, John, before all of this, we were thinking it was going to be vials and syringes and cold storage, but those issues apparently have been pretty much solved. It's little things like the lipids that have come to bite them you know where.
You know, a lot of people are eager to get the vaccine because they hope it'll sort of return to normal life. But there's a scientific reason why we should want to pick up the pace as well, isn't there?
Yes, because the coronavirus, like every virus, is constantly mutating. And the more time it has to mutate and we're still in an uncontrolled pandemic mode, the more likely the vaccines, which are currently in approval phase, won't be effective. And so it's a bit of a race. We're running this race for a ton of reasons, as you allude to, but there's also a scientific component. We want to get these vaccines into people's arms as quickly as possible so that we don't get an additional mutation that might be more virulent and might not be responsive to the vaccinations.
And with this slow pace, there's also a little bit of vaccine envy, isn't there?
You know, there really is. I think if you and I were talking about this a year ago and we said it's going to be, you know, a year and a half before in theory, people will all be vaccinated, we'd say, oh, that's manageable. And certainly given the fact that it normally takes a decade, we might conceptually say that's okay. But now we're in a period of time where our neighbors, our friends, my father are all getting vaccinated and I'm not. And I'm thinking, gosh, I'd really like to be vaccinated too. So there's a component of psychology here which makes people a little bit impatient. But let's not forget, this has been unprecedented in every level. And these big companies have sort of been building the airplane in flight, if you will.
Miles O'Brien on the vaccine progress or lack of progress. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, John.
Supply shortages and thousands of appointments canceled indefinitely. Europe's vaccination rollout is in crisis. Manufacturing delays have led to the bloc being left short of millions of vaccines. The European Union wants to see 70% of its population inoculated by the fall. But frustration is growing among its citizens amid the realization those targets could be out of reach. Special correspondent Lucy Huff has this report.
It was a race to set up this vaccine facility in the suburbs of Paris on time. By the first week of February, the centre was due to welcome hundreds of people to receive their first dose. But the vaccine supplies never arrived, and those appointments cancelled. The white tents here for now stand empty, and for the staff, it's a waiting game.
Nous avons 800 personnes qui sont préinscrites.
We have 800 people on a waiting list to get vaccinated here. The site was built in just 72 hours, ready to meet the demand of those who wanted to get the shot and be protected. But now the government can't give us a date of when we might be able to open our doors because they don't know how many doses they'll get and when.
Le nombre de doses qui seront disponibles.
It's a story repeated across Europe. A mass vaccination program that was due to begin with nursing homes, health workers and the elderly, but is now stalled due to manufacturing delays. The supply shortages have left many vulnerable citizens scrambling to find an appointment. 78-year-old Peter Wilkitsky in Berlin should have been one of the first in line in his country's rollout.
I cannot predict when it will be my turn to be vaccinated, and I have no possibility even to apply. I must wait until I get the invitation by the health services. They will probably inform me in the next 2 months.
26 million vaccine doses were delivered to the European Union by mid-February, with around two-thirds of them used. That's just a fraction of the EU's population of 450 million. All three of the vaccines authorised for use, Moderna, BioNTech, Pfizer and Oxford AstraZeneca, have cut deliveries in the first quarter. Pfizer has not yet delivered around 10 million doses that were due in December, leaving the bloc a third short. Rates of production at European sites across the board have been unable to meet demand. Ursula von der Leyen, European Commission President and German herself, has admitted mistakes were made.
It is also a fact that today, in the fight against the virus, we are still not where we want to be. We were late to authorize. We were too optimistic when it came to massive production. And perhaps we were too confident that what we ordered would actually be delivered on time.
It's led to a standoff between the EU and pharmaceutical giants, with delays set to continue for at least 2 months, whilst production capacity on the continent is ramped up.
Tensions reached breaking point when AstraZeneca announced it would be cutting its deliveries to the EU by tens of millions of doses in the first quarter, leading to a furious row. Those tensions were exacerbated by the fact that there was a smooth rollout of the same jab in the UK, which reported no supply issues. It's forced the EU to turn increasingly inward.
Europe is a major vaccine manufacturing hub and exports millions of doses each month, but the bloc has now placed export controls on vaccine deliveries to make sure that what's made here isn't being shipped overseas at the expense of European citizens. Those new export controls, coupled with the issues of supply, are beginning to be felt beyond the EU's borders. Vaccine exports to Canada this month have been slashed. Frustrated lawmakers in Europe say global cooperation needs to improve, pointing their fingers directly at US policy. Peter Lisa is a member of the European Parliament.
We have a problem with the United States. Donald Trump made an export ban, and that's why the European Union is supplying the world. Canada ordered more vaccine than the European Union, but because there is a problem in the Belgium plant, there is no vaccine coming to Canada. There's nothing from the US going to Canada. European Union has to supply Canada, and that's a problem.
The EU is looking for cooperation, not just from the US, but from the neighbouring UK, recently departed from the bloc. Unshackled from Brussels, the UK has given a first shot to a third of its adult population, compared to less than 5% in France and Germany. It negotiated bilateral deals directly with pharmaceutical firms. But the UK has taken a different approach, administering the first dose amongst all high-risk groups and delaying the second shot.
Our government has been excellent at ordering a variety and a large supply of many different vaccines. This sort of combined effort that we've done in the UK from all sorts of different groups that have led to the great success in our immunisation strategy.
The progress of the UK is being watched with envy from across the English Channel as Europe's vaccination programme grinds to a near halt. It's pushed some European countries to take matters into their own hands. Hungary has become the first member state to unilaterally authorise the Russian Sputnik V shot without EU regulatory approval. Other European nations are being forced to wait as they again shut down borders to international travel and grapple with containing new COVID-19 variants, now spreading fast. Meanwhile, tens of millions of elderly European citizens await their first dose. Weeks of idle and empty vaccine centres like this one in Paris could come at a heavy economic and human cost. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lucy Hoff in Brussels.
And now from a continent in chaos to Britain, where, as we just heard, vaccinations are proceeding at a great pace. But one of the world's strictest lockdown remains. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced yesterday a cautious timetable to end it. Schools will reopen in 2 weeks, but the full lockdown won't end until June at the earliest. Special correspondent Malcolm Brabant reports on the stress that remains.
Like a murmuration of starlings, the coronavirus has been swooping unpredictably around Britain, changing shape, triggering alarm and frustration. Some of these starlings migrated from abroad, as have new variants of COVID, bringing death and prolonging the stagnation of lockdown. The casualty rate has fallen, but many restrictions will remain in place until the summer. Wilting beneath a barrage of emergency legislation and lack of social interaction, the British are near the end of their tether.
I'm a student. I had a part-time job and I lost my job because of the virus. The food I get here goes a long way.
Wanda, who came from Nigeria 10 years ago, is getting weekly supplies from a food bank specifically set up to help ethnic minorities in Brighton.
I'm just hanging by the thread. That's the right word to use, I think so.
The food bank was founded by Juliet Sekitoliko, originally from Uganda. This week she's provided more than 70 food parcels. As lockdown dragged and schools remained closed, demand increased, especially for families with children.
When the schools are open, at least that meal is covered by the school. But now, being that they're at home, more parents, they are struggling more than before.
If I don't have my children with me, I think it's going to affect me mentally. But with my children, I look at them and I say, I have to be strong for them.
Lockdown stress doesn't discriminate.
Well, I miss school because I have very good teachers and now I'm very upset that I'm at home, so I can't see them.
I missed playing with my friends.
Jago and Gus's mother is freelance writer Flora Watkins. Their sister Romy was born a few months before lockdown began. Romy has cerebral palsy.
We are very fortunate that the boys have each got a screen, we've got a nice house. There are people for whom it's you know, immeasurably worse. But when you see children like mine who are, you know, nice, you know, privileged middle-class children who are in their own way showing signs of anxiety and depression. Hello, I found my six-year-old just lying on the floor of his room the other day. And I was saying, what's wrong, darling? What's wrong? He said, Mommy, I just don't know. Let's put this down now, please. No, I want to go through your maths with you, Gus.
Watkins put her career on hold in March last year when lockdown closed schools. Like millions of other mothers, she shoulders the burden of educating her children at home.
And how many sweets are there?
23.
If anyone had told us that actually a year later they're still going to be doing this, with no end in sight, I don't know, I think there would have been an epidemic of women sticking their heads in ovens. I can't believe we've lived like this for so long.
For much of the past year, Mike Herbert has been marooned in a cramped student house in Brighton. At 27 years old, he's clinging to the hope that music can save him from 9-to-5 tedium. Herbert is currently furloughed from a part-time sales job that was funding his music degree. His lessons are remote. Collaboration, vital for musical growth, is non-existent.
It's not quite depression, but it's nearly there. It's almost despondent.
Herbert takes a rare break from solitude, visiting a friend with a home studio to record vocals for his composition, Resist. Strictly speaking, he's breaking the law.
I can resist!
My dream is to become a successful musician. That's what I've always wanted to do. And then this came and hit me like a train.
Herbert contemplated dropping out, but limited plans to reopen some university courses soon offered hope.
There's still a chance for this to work for me. I'm determined. I want to get there.
Half a mile away, Venos Savides scans the horizon for potential customers. Savides, who has Greek Cypriot heritage, manages the family fish restaurant. There's no chance of a table. Sit-down service has been banned for months.
We've definitely lost half of our revenues over the year, and we're hoping that we're going to be open in summer.
According to the planned timetable, that should happen. Until then, takeouts must suffice.
We're happy as long as we're paying all our costs and we get the exposure to our customers so you don't lose them over the long term. I think they've done a brilliant job in the UK rolling out this vaccine, and I'm hopeful that by summer we're going to see some sort of normal working conditions again.
Despite Britain's vaccination programme racing ahead, the government became increasingly authoritarian.
Virtually all foreign travel has now been outlawed, and hawkish ministers are threatening jail terms of up to 10 years and fines of nearly $14,000 for those who break lockdown laws.
One newspaper compared Britain to a prison island, on top of which Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been widely criticised for not resisting the government's cautious scientific advisers.
I sympathise very much with the exhaustion and the stress that people are experiencing and the businesses are experiencing after so long in lockdown. But to them, and to them all, I say that today the end really is in sight.
The lockdown must be lifted so that we can move on, try to look for jobs to survive.
The thing that really, really makes me and a lot of my friends very, very angry is that there is absolutely no acknowledgement from this government about how hard it's been on women. It's women who are shouldering the brunt of the homeschooling, whose careers are suffering, who are being refused furlough for childcare reasons, women who are being made redundant.
And we owe mums everywhere an enormous debt of thanks for doing the enormously difficult job of juggling childcare and work at this tricky time.
There is absolutely no understanding of what it's like inhabiting the working mother sphere.
Britain's road to freedom depends on the virus. If it emulates the Starling murmuration and surges back, the country's lockdown blues will continue and possibly get worse. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant in Brighton.
It is an important change in parenting here in the U.S. More and more older adults are raising children for the second time around because of illness, incarceration, addiction, or any number of reasons. Stephanie Sy reports on grandparents who are caring for their grandchildren and what they're up against in the pandemic.
One, two, three.
Joanne Clow brought up two kids on her own. She never imagined that she'd have another child to raise at the age of 64, a very lively one.
It's just not something you economically plan for. I'm a single grandmother rolling the rock back up the hill.
How old are you, Carter? There's no way you're four. You look like you're five.
Bomber, what do you see?
Carter's mother, Emily, Joanne's oldest daughter, died of a fentanyl overdose in 2016.
I every day grieve Emily's loss of Carter because she'll do something cute, or, and I just think, oh my God, Emily, I can't believe you're missing this. You know, I just can't believe you're missing this.
The opioid epidemic has contributed to the growing number of grandparents raising grandchildren, says gerontologist Megan Dolben McNabb.
There is a priority within the child welfare system to place children with relatives whenever that's possible. And that's due to the fact that it's helpful to maintain those connections.
Give lovey kisses.
It also saves the system money, a cost that is often borne by grandparents who can't afford it. 19% of grand families live in poverty.
Many of them are on limited incomes. For many grandparents, the addition of those expenses really kind of overwhelm the resources that they have.
Lisa Lennon was making it work with a cleaning business that allowed her to support her grandkids, 12-year-old Luke and little Jackson, still in diapers. But since the pandemic, she's lost most of her clients.
You barely keep your head above the water, and that doesn't feel very good. It doesn't allow me to feel like I can provide everything Jackson needs, everything Luke needs, and also survive.
Behind on rent, she's worried about getting evicted.
How are you doing with food?
We get food from the church, and we run short toward the end of the month, but we stretch it out and make it work.
Since the start of the pandemic, almost 40% of grand families say they struggle to pay for housing. A third have trouble accessing food.
I was strong and confident in my ability to care for the children and myself, for that matter. But this is, at this point, I think, you know, psychologically, I feel knocked down just based on not being able to sustain myself and having to ask others for help because I'm used to helping everyone else. So not used to that.
I wish I had someone's sofa that I could lay on for 2 hours and just cry my eyeballs out.
Having a good cry would be a luxury these days, says Lisa Banks. She's got three grandchildren at home doing virtual school.
I'm trying to spread myself thin amongst three kids, which is difficult. A lot of the work I don't understand because I've been out of school so long and things have changed so much.
And with no school lunch, the dishes and the bills are piling up.
It's like, I'm hungry. You hear it all day. So it's breakfast, it's snack. It's lunch, it's snack. It's dinner, it's snacks. You're spending it more in utilities because they're using more electricity. Everything goes up.
Any of this stuff here, you can take as much as you want.
Banks recently found some help through a local nonprofit group called Gratitude for Grandparents. Every Sunday, founder Rhea Kelsall distributes donated food and essentials from her basement.
So many of the families had part-time jobs that lost their jobs. They have less income now than they had prior to the pandemic. Gratitude for Grandparents is here for them.
Kelsall herself can relate. She and her fiance are raising two grandchildren between them, also because of substance addiction.
Carl's my fiance's biological grandson, and his dad is deceased from an overdose. I do sometimes think that the big G had a plan because we understand what the other one is going through.
And they've gone through a lot. The latest hurdle, the pandemic forced Kelsall to close the daycare she was running.
Totally lost my income, and now we're on his fixed income.
Kelsall, like most grandparents, is raising the kids outside of the foster care system.
They're your blood. You want to take them home and
take care of them, love them, and everything else, it's not even a consideration.
But without legal custody or guardianship, it can be tough to tap into government support services.
There can be eligibility requirements that push some grandparents out, and many of them really struggle. And I think with the pandemic, particularly for grandparents who might have been laid off or are not getting income from other family members that maybe they're used to, it can be very devastating.
Nonprofits like CalSOLS are trying to fill the need, which includes emotional support. We joined the group's monthly Zoom meeting.
I just wanted to see if I could see a show of hands.
I asked who thought the pandemic had compounded the challenges they face.
Me.
Not surprisingly, every hand went up.
Never did I think I would be this short of breath.
61-year-old grandmother Kim Aaliyah was recovering from COVID-19.
My oxygen was at 86, and I was truly afraid to die because what would happen to Brooklyn?
Brooklyn is the 11-year-old grandchild she's raised since she was a baby.
It was absolutely mind-numbing, the fear that I had.
With the cloud of COVID, there's worry.
I wake up thinking about these kids, and I go to sleep thinking about them.
With the shadow of the past, there's worry.
They've experienced a great deal of trauma in their lives. And I mean, what they need, they can't have, their mother.
The grandkids' mental health weighs on Paul and Barb Anderson.
This thing of the kids going to school on the computer and not having a social life just exacerbates the problem, I think.
Oh, we got the kale too.
As heavy as the burden may sometimes be, the children, says Lisa Lennon, are also what lift her up.
They're my inspiration and reason to wake up these days.
On good days and bad days, says Lisa Banks.
You go through those moments, you go through those stressors, you cry, you fight, you argue, whatever it takes, but you're still there at the end.
And that's what really matters. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
It is a tumultuous time in the news business. Significant percentages of Americans fundamentally don't trust news sources that don't line up with their opinions. And the financial landscape is perilous. Last week, Tribune Publishing, which owns 9 major daily metro newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune, announced that it was turning over complete control to Alden Global Capital, a hedge fund widely seen as gutting editorial coverage at newspapers. Only one of the Tribune's papers, the Baltimore Sun, will now be turned into a not-for-profit and owned by a Maryland business executive and philanthropist. We examine some pressing questions of the moment with two who know this well. Gregory Moore is a former editor of the Denver Post. He's now editor-in-chief at Deke Digital. It's a company that advises corporate executives. And Radhika Jones. She's the editor of Vanity Fair. She also worked at the New York Times and at Time Magazine before taking over Vanity Fair. It's so good to see both of you. Thank you for being here. Let's start by talking about this business model. It used to be that newspapers, broadcast outlets, sold advertising, people bought things, and somehow there was enough money to pay newspaper and broadcast reporters' salaries. Gregory Moore, what do we have now?
Well, you have a lot of uncertainty. Google and Facebook really changed the advertising landscape. They gobbled up somewhere in the neighborhood of 90 or 95% of the media advertising, and so local news organizations in particular have had to go looking for other ways to sort of finance the collection and dissemination of news. And what's really exciting about it is that we're looking at new models and new opportunities from foundations, owning and supporting news operations to taxpayer supported formulas that will work, corporate donations and things of that nature that 15 years ago, we wouldn't even look at. But I think we've got to find a new model. The advertising one is broken, and it's really critical to the success of a local news environment.
And Radhika Jones, you were telling us that while we're figuring all this out, local coverage, local news coverage, has taken a big hit.
It has. There are certain national news outlets that have become a lot stronger in, say, the last decade, decade and a half. And local news has suffered in large part because of the collapse of things like classified ads, which are now such a relic of the past. But the irony is that local news often is national news. I think about what happened with the blackouts in Texas and the way that all of our eyes were trained on those events. And it was, reporting from Texas Monthly and from the paper in Houston and places like that, that really helped bring clarity to that situation and hold powerful people to account.
Greg Moore, while all this is going on, you have the deepest political polarization across the country that we've ever seen. People gravitating toward, as I mentioned a moment ago, news sources that reflect their own opinion. There was a Pew study that came out today that said one quarter of Republicans consistently turn to news sources with right-leaning audiences. Same for Democrats, a quarter of Democrats doing the same. And then you have a half of Democrats and a third of Republicans turning to sources, news sources that try to serve a mainstream audience. What has all this meant for the challenges facing journalists?
Well, one of the things that it's meant is, sort of a lack of a common sense or a common set of facts. As these particularly local news organizations have, lost their ability to sort of more broadly cover issues, our collective sense of what's going on in our communities has really been disrupted. I think the second thing that's happened is that, we've lost some credibility. The fake news assault over the last four and a half years has really had some effect. We've lost somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,800 newspapers, to be specific, 1,800 newspapers in probably the last, 10 years. And with that, we've lost a lot of institutional memory. But more than that, those newspapers had 150 years of credibility. They're being replaced by upstarts that really haven't earned their right to be to be where they are. And so the way that they're doing it is by appealing to, what people already think they know, right? They're confirming the very limited sort of siloed existence that they have. And it's really contributing to a breakdown of the sense of community. It's really, we're at a perilous moment here. It doesn't mean that it's going to last, but we're at a perilous moment where we can't even agree on a common set of facts because of the fractured nature of the media.
And Radhika Jones, how has that affected the journalism you can do at Vanity Fair and what you see others doing? And do you think this is a trust that can be regained?
I do think it can be regained. I am an optimist on that front. And I think that the mere fact that we are having these conversations and drawing attention to it, I hope is a helpful step in the right direction. I mean, one thing that has happened, especially in the last 4 years with the assault on the media and the media's credibility has been a lot of hostility toward members of the press and reporters who I work with, both at Vanity Fair and places in the past who've endured threats and, incredible hostility simply for doing their jobs. And I think that the more we can shine a light on that and start to reestablish in a transparent way the fact that people in the media are not the enemy. They are actually holding powerful people to account. They are providing clarity. They are providing a service, and often a very community-based service. I think the more we can show that, show our processes, make decisions in transparent ways, the better off we will be.
I know that's something we think about every day, all the time. At the NewsHour. The other thing I want to bring up with both of you, Greg Moore, is, while all this is happening, there's a generational change. I mean, there is a turnover in leadership at a number of major news organizations. There's an increasing call in this age of Black Lives Matter, and within the last year, the death of George Floyd, there's a call for more diversity, more inclusion in newsrooms. Journalists have talked about this for a long time, but we still have a long way to go. How do you see the progress that's being made, and how much difference does it make that there is progress?
Well, certainly, you know, having diverse newsrooms is hugely important to covering stories like Black Lives Matter and, you know, policing in America, income inequality. You know, having people who have experienced some of that, who actually understand, you know, what that's like, really contributes to how a story like that gets covered. You know, we're, you know, when the economy is bad, the first thing that really goes in news organizations is diversity. And we are witnessing, you know, what I've described as the whitening of the media. You know, we've lost a lot. And one of the ways that, you know, we get it back is to shine a light on it, as Radhika was saying, and make sure that we explain that while we may be losing the diversity that, you know, is so important in newspapers, you know, these new digital upstarts that are being created, they need to put an emphasis on diversity. If you look at a lot of these digital verticals that have been created in the last 10 years, they're almost exclusively white. And that really affects the kinds of stories that get covered, you know, who gets to tell the stories, who gets included as sources and things of that nature. And I would say, you know, next to the financial stability of the media, the second most important thing is inclusion and a diversity of voices, not just on a reporting level, but on the editing level, on the producer level, and certainly in the chief executive office.
And Radhika Jones, how do you see the imperative here? How much difference does it make that this happens? Is it happening at the pace it should be happening at?
I think one always wants it to happen faster. It is a work in progress. Again, I think that the fact that we're having these conversations and that they're, in my experience, at least more robust than they've ever been, is cause for optimism. But I do agree that it's extremely important. And it does come back around to that local news question, because often local news, where it exists, is able to serve otherwise marginalized or underserved communities. And so to be able to have a diverse group of reporters and writers and editors, and more than that, podcasters, audience development executives, everyone now who contributes to multi-platform news, to be able to have those people come from different places, represent different modes of storytelling, represent different points of view, is going to be critical, I think, for our success going forward.
And you raise a point that does get back to something I know we're all interested in. As we democratize, if you will, small d, the coverage of news, as the public, the audience is more involved in what we cover, there are fewer editors. How much should we worry about that? How does that figure in to journalism as it moves into the future, Greg Moore?
Judy, you know, I don't confuse, you know, citizens with being journalists. I mean, there's more to being a journalist than, you know, jotting down notes or recording a conversation. There's a whole different level of accountability and verifying and things of that nature. But I do think that the people that we cover need to have a stronger voice in what that coverage looks like. They should be able to interact. They should be able to get resolution to errors and omissions in real time. You know, when I was coming up in this business, if we made a mistake, we basically tried to negotiate our way out of it. Next time we'll do better. Well, that's not good enough now. I think that the damage that can be done by, you know, portraying communities or individuals, you know, incorrectly is much longer lasting with the web. And so, you know, being able to interact and being able to influence coverage and actually understanding how that's done, I think is one of the most important reasons that women and people of color and other underserved and marginalized folks need to be a part of the media power chain in this country to demystify it.
We thank you very much, Radhika Jones, Greg Moore. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So grateful to both of them. Such an important subject for all of us. And that is the News Hour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.